Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Clary, Judge Dovery Bjorkman, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes Jr. presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, June 12th, 2019. We have six cases on our calendar for today. Three are set for oral argument, of which the first one is A19-0074, Daniel Call versus Ralph Call. I believe both parties are familiar with our processes in terms of 15 minutes for each side and 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant, if you so choose. Feel free to adjust the podium. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kaynard Hunt, and I represent the appellant, Ralph Call. Appellant Ralph Call is chief executive officer of Winco and has been CEO since he joined Winco, then known as Energex, back in the 1980s. He has never ceded that position. As CEO, Ralph Call, in accord with Minnesota Statute Section 302A.305, has the power and authority to manage the Winco business.
But does he have the authority to fire the president?
He has the authority to fire an employee.
He has the ability to fire an employee, but can he fire the president?
No, he did not fire the president.
That wasn't the question. Can he fire the president?
Under the bylaws, it would appear that he could not. Okay. There might be an exception under the statute, but that the bylaws would govern the office of president. But here we're talking about terminating Daniel Call as an employee.
In what capacity as an employee?
He was a general manager.
Okay, so if he can fire him as a general, what support is there in the record for that?
Ralph Call's testimony, there was the question asked as to what his position was, and it's general manager, and I've responded to that in my reply brief, citing that portion of the transcript.
Okay, but that's not a finding on the district court, though, that he served in the capacity of general manager.
No, because unfortunately, the trial court went to the idea of being terminated as an officer and did not address it in terms of being terminated as an employee.
What effect, if any, does that have, though, if he still remains as an employee of the corporation in the position of president?
Well, he doesn't remain an employee of the corporation as position of president. He remains an officer of the corporation.
But that's still an employment position.
No, it's not. It's an officer position.
An officer position is still an employment position of the corporation.
No, it's not. There is a distinction between being an officer and being an employee. And so, for example,
there is a distinction in the sense of the power that the president has. But the president is still an employee of the corporation. Under what authority what's your basis to say that a president of a corporation is not an employee?
Well, because there is a distinction made. So, for example, as an employee, he's subject to the handbook, but as a president of the corporation, as an officer isn't necessarily subject to the handbook. So there is a distinction that's made between an officer and an employee. So, and the law generally is that an employee position is created by the officer, an officer position is created by the bylaws. So there's that distinction. So when we're talking about termination, we're talking a termination as an employee, as a general manager, not termination as an officer. And I've cited to this court, it doesn't come up that often, but there was a case out of Ohio where the court recognizes that you can be terminated as an employee, but you still can be an officer, and vice versa. You know, they're not inextricably tied.
Right, but the cases that you cite in your main brief, the Pedro case and the other one, those are, the distinction there is a shareholder versus an employee position. So I don't think those cases are applicable.
Right,
Ohio cases is not binding on us.
But I think the law generally is that an officer can be an employee, but an office, but they can also be distinct. And here he was terminated as an employee. He can continue on as an officer.
So you do agree an officer can be an employee then?
Can be an employee, but here he was terminated as an employee. He can continue on as an officer. Under the facts of the case, Ralph Call testified at the transcript, page 177, that he could and did delegate, but he still maintained ultimate supervisory authority, and respondent Daniel Call admitted to that. And Daniel Call admitted at trial that with the 2015 gift of stock by which Daniel became the majority shareholder, Ralph Call remained CEO. And after the 2015 gift, nothing changed. Daniel continued to report to Ralph as CEO with the stock transfer, and Ralph was still the decision maker.
Right. He reported to Ralph as Daniel reported to Ralph as a CEO, meaning he is. That just seems to go to the point of him being an employee. I want to switch gears real quick, counsel, and talk briefly about the second issue that you raised in terms of enjoyment of Ralph.
Right.
And when I look at that, your argument seems to focus on the district court, quote unquote, sua sponte, enjoining Ralph. Now, you would agree that the district court does have broad discretion in terms of whether to grant a TRO, correct?
Correct.
And in terms of what relief the district court can craft based on the particular facts of the case, right?
But you need to have notice that is in the mix. So, for example...
Right, and you do have to have notice, and that's part of the due process. I certainly agree with you there. But my question goes to the fact that Ralph actually brought a motion for a TRO.
He did.
And that motion was granted by the district court. The
Correct.
District court enjoined Daniel and said, you can't appoint your wife as a shareholder, that action is void. But the district court, also looking at the particular facts of the case, said, Ralph, you can't terminate Daniel, and you can't adjourn or commence a shareholder meeting either.
Well, he went broader than that.
But basically, here's my perspective on it. The district court judge said, okay, neither one of you play nice with each other. Both of you get a timeout. I'm going to enjoin both of you from taking any further action to try to change things, because both parties had the potential as shareholders to try to do something to oust the other one. And the district court said, no. I'm going to put a standstill here. I'm going to appoint a special master to try to get this issue resolved here. And it seems to me that the district court acted in response to Ralph's motion for a TRO to craft equitable relief. Why is that an abuse of its discretion?
A number of reasons. One, the trial court issued no findings of fact to go with the injunction. It doesn't even state what authority purports to be acting under. There's no Dahlberg factors that are analyzed in granting the injunction.
Well, but in terms of the action, it was in response to Ralph's.
It still doesn't matter, Your Honor. I mean, I don't care if it's in response to whomever. The court has the obligation to make findings of fact and follow the law with regard to the Dahlberg factors.
The district court did say, hey, both of you are acting outside of your authority. I'm putting a halt to all the actions, and we're basically turning back the clock to pre-December 2018.
Well, this is where I have a problem with what Your Honor just said. Ralph Call was CEO. The court, in its grant of injunctive relief, said he couldn't exercise supervisory authority. Well, that's what a CEO does. So we have Ralph Call as a CEO with the trial court enjoining him from exercising exactly what he is and what the court had already found, that he continued to be CEO after the trial on the merits. Now, I think what's important to this case is the fact that the trial court was doing this purportedly to maintain status quo while post-trial motions were being under consideration. The trial court then issued its amended judgment, reaffirming that Ralph Kahl is CEO. Accordingly, this injunction must have dissolved. It dissipates. It's a nothing now, given the fact that we have this amended judgment addressing the post-trial motion on the merits. And the problem is any kind of notion that this injunction order is still out there and live and that it can somehow govern what is going on today. That's why the issue is being raised.
Well, but it's continuing on through the appointment of the special master, who now has authority to try to resolve the issue and then report back to the district court.
Right, but what you cannot...
So it's not a nullity or a void.
It is a nullity because once the court issues the judgment, the amended judgment, he says he's doing this because of post-trial motions. Once he rules on those and he reaffirms that Ralph Kahl is CEO, you can't have in place this interim order that says he can't execute executive authority. Then he's not CEO.
Ms. Hunt, that TRO that your client had requested, was that not, though, to enjoin the request legally by the documents that Daniel had to call a special meeting? So, in effect, didn't he invoke, that's what's kind of rose to the request of the court to invoke a stoppage of the legal authority that these two parties have to take action?
He did in terms of limited to the shareholders' meetings, the board of directors' meetings. There was not a motion made to enjoin Ralph. So that did not occur. But whatever occurred at that point in time, you can have a situation where you would then have the court rule on the post-trial motions. We're here on the amended judgment. And the amended judgment declares Ralph Kahl is CEO.
Do you believe that under the rules, both for injunction and appointment of special master, that assuming both parties had brought a motion and there's a full hearing, the court would have ongoing authority in this type of situation, both under those rules as well as the statute, to provide for special master an injunction to work on matters post-judgment?
I don't think that you can continue an injunction like this post-judgment. I mean, you can't contradict the judgment. And that's what the trial court has done. With regard to the special master, it's always been somewhat of a mystery in the sense that no one requested a special master. There's no findings as to a special master. And that's kind of this whole process was kind of, I mean, there's no record even of the hearing.
Right, but you would agree that the district court does have authority, inherent authority, to appoint a special master to take care of matters and do it in a way that may be more expeditious than the district court can do.
Well, I think that you can appoint a special master if you have a record basis, you make the appropriate findings as to why you have a special master and under what authority you're purporting to do this, but we have nothing. I mean, we just have this order, but our concern is not so much with the special master.
Okay.
But it's our concern is with that injunction order that says that Ralph Kahl cannot exercise executive authority. Because you can't have that sitting there with an amended judgment that says Ralph Kahl is CEO.
Right, but that is what's detailed in the appointment of the special master in terms of what he cannot do in terms of his actions with respect to the president. He can't fire the president. So it outlines what he cannot do and what needs to be resolved with respect to the special
master. But the special master cannot keep in place the idea that Ralph Kahl doesn't exercise executive authority when you have a judgment of the district court following that appointment that says that Ralph Kahl is chief executive officer. I mean, you cannot have those sitting in tandem, and the judgment, the amended judgment, rules. It has to. Otherwise, we don't have any rule of law here. I mean, we've had a trial on the merits. The trial court has determined that the situation is that which existed before December 17th, that Ralph Call is chief executive officer. We know that as chief executive officer, he had the supervisory authority. So how can you then reinstate or say that he's CEO, state it in the amended judgment, but say you don't have an executive authority?
Well, I don't read the order as broadly saying that he cannot do anything at all as CEO.
Well, it says
What language? Can you point to in the record where exactly it says
it's in
CEO in title only? I think that's contrary to the
if I can
order,
quickly
all
grab.
The orders, including the order for the appointment of special master.
If you look at paragraph 10 at addendum 16, Ralph Call is specifically enjoined from exercising any executive authority over Winco. You cannot have that order and then turn around and say in the amended judgment, Ralph Call is chief executive officer of Winco. I ask that this court reverse.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, judges. May it please the court. My name is Corey Genlin, and I'm here on behalf of my client, the respondent, Dan Call. My plan is to go through the issues roughly in order, but taking issue number two until the end. Obviously, that will depend on your questions.
Actually, if you could start with number two, why don't you finish, if you can continue
It comes down to the district court having the equitable power to craft a remedy it sees fit. You have to remember that the overall problem here was twofold. Number one, there was one shareholder director officer, Ralph, who refused to allow this corporation to be governed by Minnesota law. Majority vote of the shareholders, majority vote of directors, and such. The problem on the other end of that spectrum was that the parties, without talking about it, without changing the bylaws, said, you know what, you be CEO, I'll be president, let's go. Never sat down to decide what exactly that meant. And so essentially we had two generals and no soldiers. And that was why the parties were unable to make this two-vote democracy work. So after victory at trial, my client got the order that he wanted that said, yep, this Minnesota court operates, or this Minnesota corporation operates just like every other Minnesota corporation. My client said, all right, armed with that, I can fix this problem. I can call a shareholders meeting. The shareholders will elect a new board of directors that is not a two-vote democracy. It'll be an odd number. And the board of directors, just like any other corporation, will govern the corporation, and they will resolve this dispute between the officers. That's what my client wanted. So my client noted a shareholders meeting because that's how you control a corporation. Ralph wanted that shareholders meeting stopped. My client did not want an injunction. My client did not want the appointment of a special master. My client wanted a shareholders meeting.
So did the district court err or abuse its discretion then by issuing an injunction against Ralph?
No.
So it sounds like you're arguing now then. It sounds like you're agreeing with Pallant.
No, because part of that discretion is, it's not as if you walk into a district court and say, I want this exact injunction or I want nothing at all. You don't get that. Kind of like my son asked to borrow the car, I get to say, you may borrow the car, but you're washing it and you're going to be home by 10 o'clock, okay? If, and particularly in this case, blocking that shareholders meeting and lawful functioning of the Minnesota Corporation was the only way to govern this nightmare, this two-vote democracy. Ralph got his injunction blocking that. And if we're going to block that legal function, if we're not going to let the corporation be governed by its shareholders, we've got to do something about this two-vote democracy that got us here. I don't think the district court had in mind to permanently enjoin Ralph from
being... Can I ask that question? That's what I wanted to get to, Mr. Genlin. What do you envision, and Ms. Hunt raises a good point, that the judge confirmed in the amended order that indeed Ralph is CEO, and yet the injunction went on. By the order, I see appointing special master where that language is, and especially paragraph 10, well, both 9 and 10, there's no ending date. Number one, the question is legally, Should that have been lifted, a point at which the court issued the amended judgment and then let the parties to the, and somehow redraft perhaps the special master order?
Well,
and then even in that case, when would that end?
Ironically, and I forget what order these came in, but my client brought a post-trial motion to dissolve the order appointing the special master. Ralph correctly said, fine, dissolve it, but dissolve the injunction on me too. And I think we both agreed that it's all or nothing, that you can't take away a small portion of this cohesive injunctive relief, but that is what Dan Call wants. He wants this corporation to be governed by the shareholders. He doesn't want it to be governed by the court system anymore. So if the shareholders are allowed to meet and function as an equitable matter, we're fine having the injunction against Ralph removed. But that's not what the judge did, and this court, not sitting as a court of equity, is not in a absent abuse of discretion. I don't think this court is in a position to tweak the district court's equitable remedy without having the entire structure collapse.
Okay, but looking at it, it seems to be not quite equal here, because looking at Addendum 16, paragraph 9, it says Dan Call is specifically enjoined from holding a shareholders meeting until receiving permission from Mr. Van den North. But then the next paragraph has no limitation in terms of until receiving permission, and just says, well, Call is specifically enjoined from exercising any executive authority over Winco. So it sounds like the district court is saying, Ralph, as a CEO, you can't do anything, and there's no end date in sight. How does that make any sense at all in terms of enjoining both parties?
It's not equal, but that doesn't mean it's an abuse of discretion. My client got a better deal out of this injunction. My client won on the injunction level. He had to live with the special master. He had to have his shareholders meeting enjoined. He lost a little bit, but yeah, he walked out of that hearing in better shape than the other side.
Okay, my question is more kind of a practical one, though. How can Ralph, as the CEO of the corporation, run the corporation if he is specifically enjoined from exercising any executive authority over Winco? It's not limited just to particular actions he cannot take toward Dan. It's you can't do anything.
And my answer, Judge, is descriptive, not normative. Under the current order, as an officer, he can't. He can't operate as CEO. That is my interpretation. I think it's Ralph's interpretation of what the order says. He's still a director. He's still chairman of the board of directors. He still attends directors' meetings. That is his only power. And that is a very strong equitable remedy. But we got here because we had two officers pointing at each other saying, you're fired, and calling the police to remove each other. We had a big problem, and the district court gave us big relief.
So you don't think that's an abuse of discretion to strip a CEO of all authority to act by a district court?
In the context of also placing handcuffs on the people that should govern a corporation, the shareholders, I don't think that's an abuse of discretion.
Say that again in terms of what do you mean by placing handcuffs?
If we took this in isolation and said taking all executive power away from the CEO, that would be an extreme remedy. But in the context of number one, part of the context here is that while Dan conceded that in his capacity as officer president, he was subordinate to Ralph as officer CEO, the facts also show that over the past several years, and this is in the findings, that Ralph's involvement waned and he became increasingly less and less involved. So don't think of this as taking a CEO who is present at the company every day and suddenly taking away all his powers. Think of this as taking a gentleman who lives in Utah, who in the last year before this conflict visited the company five times, and in a context where the parties even created this mess by saying, you're president, you're CEO, but we don't really know what that means. In that context, that takes some of the extremity off it. But more importantly, again, if the judge, my client wanted to govern the corporation by vote of shares, which the trial order says that he can do. And if the judge is going to stop him from doing that, then the judge also needs to put up a lot of other barriers to stop the exact same fight from happening. Because in a functioning corporation, not subject to judicial supervision, if two officers turn to each other and both say, you're fired, then they both go to the board of directors, and the board of directors deals with the situation. But the situation we were in at that time was a two-member board of directors, both of them litigants, and there was just no way for it to function other than getting that shareholders meeting done.
Mr. Gentleman, you talked about the weight of the remedy. Isn't that precisely what Ms. Hunt's referring to in terms of the abuse of discretion, that a temporary injunction, which should be rare in any case, when the Dahlberg factors themselves are not analyzed to see how the balancing of the effect on the parties, the relationship of the parties, and the likelihood of the success on the merits. Now, that one may have been resolved, as you pointed out, in part of it, but there's a lot of factors which then we can then have looked at to see whether there's an abuse of discretion in giving such a significant remedy.
Again, it is significant. Another piece of context here is that Ralph has been judicially enjoined from exercising authority since January of 2018. So this wasn't a new thing. Throughout the course of litigation, the only functioning executive of this corporation was Dan Call. Again, my client wants all of this dissolved. My client made a motion to have all this dissolved. This court would be exercising equitable powers by tweaking the judge's equitable remedy. And more practically speaking, I think we're very close to both sides wanting all post-trial injunctions gone.
I'm presuming, by the way, when you say that, that's subject to this court's denial of the other issue related to Ralph's decision regarding Daniel and his role as CEO versus employee, or as president versus employee.
Yeah, do you have specific questions on that, or would you like me to go at it?
My point I'm getting at is that as your client's envisioning everything being dropped, it would be, of course, him remaining majority shareholder. As I understand, the point of the firing is that under that separate agreement that the parties have, he would need to turn over shares. Ralph then becomes the majority shareholder.
Right, and that's what the termination is about. It's about Ralph trying to get taking back a majority interest in the company.
Right, but if he has authority to do that, why can't he? Why can't he fire Dan as a general manager and still allow him to function as president and have those shares turn over from that role as general manager?
Well, and that question assumes that he is a general manager. There was no finding at trial. The only finding as to Dan's position...
Is that an error by the district court then to not have made that finding?
No.
The
district court did have to find who Dan Call is and where he fits in the corporate hierarchy. It found that he was president. Ralph made this argument at trial that Dan had some other position. He gave testimony on that. Judge Vandalis weighed the evidence, found it wanting. One of the main things, first things that the judge looked at was Ralph's own words. Ralph wrote to Dan, "You own the company. I have given it to you. No one can remove you. You can only remove yourself." Exhibit 44. So first of all, Ralph disclaimed the ability that he now has. Second of all, there's nothing prior to this dispute of Ralph referring to Dan as anything other than president. In the record, he tells his friends, "I'm making Dan president." He tells the employees, "Dan's doing a great job as president." There's evidence of Dan being president. There's annual written action in lieu of a meeting. There is nothing evidencing this other role that he somehow has. Now, yes, Dan was president and also an employee in the same sense that he's also a leader and also a manager and also an accountant and also a man and also a payroll recipient. He's lots of things, but those are all, he's president. That's just another aspect of him. And it's not some separate employment status.
Counsel, if both sides agree that he's president and that he's a shareholder, what difference does it make if he's no longer a general manager?
Because the shareholders' agreement says that if someone is terminated, they have to tender back their shares. And that's what this is about. Ralph terminated him. And by the way, there isn't a finding that he was actually terminated. In the findings, Judge Vandalis says he claims to have terminated him. In the conclusion, he describes it as allegedly or attempting to terminate him. and he voids that. And that's another issue that the other side hasn't even talked about, is, again, that equitable power of the district court. The court exercised its power against Dan to say, yeah, I know you voted to terminate Ralph as CEO. I'm just voiding that because I can, because I think that's fair under my equitable authority. So even if the district court had found, yep, Dan is something else, he's a general manager too, the court still said, it uses the word void, I'm voiding the attempted termination. So even if they were right on facts and law, the district court still has the power to say, I don't care, it was unfair what you did, and I'm undoing it. I'm pushing you back to the status quo as of December of 2017, both sides.
Just to be clear, there are no employment agreements of any sort. I mean, there was no employment agreement such as general manager,
correct,
et cetera.
Correct. There's no shred of anything other than president before this attempted termination. So if there are no further questions, my client asks that the trial court be affirmed in full.
Thank you,
Thank
counsel.
You, Judge.
The termination notice is at my supplemental addendum at 1, dated January 2nd, terminating Daniel Call as an employee. What cannot be overlooked in this case is a shareholder agreement. Under the shareholder agreement, to be a shareholder, one must be an employee. So, and Daniel was an employee, and the undisputed testimony of record is his status as an employee was as general manager. Ralph testified as to that. Daniel never disputed that fact.
But isn't that a credibility determination to be made by the district court?
Absolutely not. It's not a credibility because there's no dispute. There is absolutely no dispute.
It doesn't matter if there's no dispute. You can still have a credibility determination if only one party testifies. The district court can either accept or reject that testimony.
But the problem, Your Honor, is if you look at the trial court's findings of fact, the trial court moves from the fact of termination of employment to the officer position, never looking at it in terms of being an employee and terminated as employee, which is undisputed on this record, that Ralph Call terminated Daniel Call as an employee, which then you have to go to the shareholder agreement and specifically paragraph 2A sub 3, which says that a discharged employee has to turn in its shares. So that's the easy way all of this gets resolved. The fact is, a CEO has the authority to terminate an employee. Daniel was terminated as an employee. He must then return his shares. Then we don't have any of this ongoing going on, and that is what the shareholder agreement provides. That's the agreement that Daniel entered into when he accepted the shares.
Is there any record of his employment as a general manager?
Other than
employment contract, anything in writing to establish
there's
that?
not of record, but Daniel himself.
Any emails, any communication saying I'm appointing you as general manager?
Well, he was because he
no,
was.
But of him specifically in the role as general manager.
Well, he was initially, of course, hired as a sales manager, and then moved into different positions, and he was general manager at the time of the termination. Again, I mean,
let me ask this question. What record, what written record is there of Daniel being in the employment role of general manager?
I think it's Daniel himself, his own testimony regard to when he wanted to carry a gun onto the premises. He came in.
I'm familiar with that.
Okay, yeah. So yeah. He's coming in as an employee. He's making the distinction himself between being an employee and being an officer.
I understand. I'm familiar with that aspect and his testimony there.
And so that's why I say there really isn't any dispute that he's an employee.
But my question is, I'm going to go back to my question again. What written record is there establishing that Daniel was, in fact, employed by the company as a general manager?
I don't recall anything, any written document. What we have of record is Ralph Call's testimony. He was subject to cross-examination. There was no questioning of that by Daniel's attorney. Daniel himself never disputed the fact that he is an employee. So when you look...
Yeah, but that's different than general manager.
I don't think it is, because...
Well, I'm drawing... Let's assume for the second there's a distinction. I'm more focused on his position as a general manager.
And all I have that I recall from the record is Ralph's testimony, but I'm not so sure why it matters what exactly his position as employee was. He's an employee. And as an employee...
It matters if he's an employee as a general manager or if he's an employee as president.
But as a president, he's an officer. He's an employee as a general manager. And so, I mean, because if you look at the shareholder agreement cares nothing about being an officer. It doesn't talk about that. It talks about being a shareholder employee. And obviously, Daniel had to be an employee to be a shareholder. Otherwise, we wouldn't even be here. So it's very important to the analysis of this case to look at how the shareholder agreement affects it, and when you apply the shareholder agreement as written as to the facts, what we have here is reversal. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. It was very extensively briefed by both parties and very well argued. We appreciate that. We'll be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you all.